Good day. My name is James Gordon, and what you are about to hear is a condensed audio version of the Guelph Ward 2 Town Hall meeting of June 27th, 2020, co-hosted with my Ward 2 councilmate, Rodrigo Galler, who moderates this discussion. Our special guest was Guelph Police Chief Gord Kobe, who had three of his officers offering their insights as well around the many issues facing police in these challenging times. This was a virtual meeting, so the sound is a little uneven, but I think you'll be able to follow along, and Rodrigo and I are grateful for your interest. Here's Rodrigo.
Before we get into the meeting, I'm going to turn it over to Councillor Gordon for a territorial land acknowledgement.
Thank you very much, Rodrigo, and welcome everybody. As we gather, we are reminded that Guelph is situated on treaty land that is steeped in rich Indigenous history and home to many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people. Today, we acknowledge the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation of the Anishinaabeg peoples on whose traditional territory we are meeting. And I'd like to personally add that as Canada Day approaches, we are reminded that Canada was founded on the racist colonialist idea that Indigenous people were inferior and expendable, so it was considered acceptable to steal land and eradicate a way of life. So in recognizing that, we all have a lot of work to do, and personally, I'm looking forward to the leadership and the stewardship that Indigenous people are showing in guiding us towards an unlearning and a learning and towards truth and reconciliation with that. Thank you.
Thank you for that, James. I'd like to now turn it over to the police chief, Gord Kobe. Welcome. Thank you for joining us, Gord. It's great to have you here.
Before I start, I just wanted to let everyone know how much we appreciate the opportunity to be with you today. And there's a couple folks here with me. Stu, can you, I'll just have any of the members of our service online. We'll start with you, and maybe just a quick intro so everyone knows who's on.
Hi, I guess I'll start. I'm Staff Sergeant Kevin King. I am the Staff Sergeant in charge of training and recruiting branch for the Guelph Police Service. I just got into that role about a month ago, and I'm happy to be sitting in on this town hall.
My name is Stu Robertson. I'm a detective constable with the Guelph Police Service. I'm currently in the Youth Crime Prevention Unit. I'm taking the role of the sergeant right now. I'm also looking after, we just did an initiative looking after a youth virtual training program that just ended on Thursday. And I'm also going to be filling in for media over the summer holidays. And I'm honored to be here with the other parties.
So Rodrigo, if it's okay with you, even if you give me a thumbs up, I'm going to start with some opening comments while Dustin comes in. So, like I said, thank you everyone for the opportunity to be with you today. We provided our board updates last week, but I wanted to really start our conversation today and talk a little bit about the very important conversation that we've all been having as a country and as a society really in the last month or so. The last several weeks have had a very significant impact on us all. As a society and as a police service, it has led to much introspection in relation to the role we have and how we are perceived by our Black, Indigenous, and people of our community. Most importantly, it has caused us all to recognize and acknowledge as a community, as a country, and as a police service, that racism, prejudice, and bias, it does exist. We are committed to listening, learning, and taking steps to better understand the extent of this reality, both within our service and our community, and taking action to achieve real and lasting change. For years, our members have worked hard to engage our community. This has included working with many groups and individuals and our youth. But clearly, we have more work to do to connect, engage, and learn from and represent our BIPOC community. We're grateful for the very significant engagement with several community leaders, including members of the Guelph Black Heritage Society, before, during, and after our event on June 6th. Their leadership provided our community the opportunity to express their voice, and for this, we're grateful. We are listening and we are learning together. As this engagement continues, We're committed to expanding the dialogue, and we continue to have excellent conversations in the last several weeks with representatives of the Guelph Black Heritage Society and other members in our community. Kevin, who's with us today, is in charge of our recruiting and training unit, and we're also including the chair of our diversity committee in these discussions. We've all committed to expanding this dialogue and working together so that our service and our community can become an example for other services and communities to follow as we seek to achieve real and lasting change. We feel it's important as we look for the discussions, and I suspect this will come up in our conversation today, as we optimize service delivery to best help those in need, it requires the consideration of many complex variables and a holistic, multidisciplinary approach to community safety and community wellness. And I think it's really important. We had an excellent conversation with Rotary on Monday. It's really important. I want the community to know how integrated our conversations have been and how our goal to achieve change is very much shared with our service and our community leaders and the leaders of the Black Heritage Society. Obviously, since March 11th, since the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic on March 11th, our members, as of yesterday morning, have responded to over 21,000 calls for service since midnight on March 12th. So if you can imagine, as individuals and as families, kind of the angst and stress that we've all had around wellness and safety and the health of our families, our service has received 21,000 calls for service. So I think it's important to note, certainly not every one of those are in-person interactions with our community. But as we've all navigated the stress and challenges of a pandemic, our members continue in many, many instances, they can't work remotely and they can't work via Zoom or WebEx or any of these other applications. They are in person day in and day out, working hard to support our community who even while we're in a pandemic, our members literally help our community navigate some of life's most difficult moments. So I think it's important that we have that in mind as we have all of our conversations. Our members, they continue to demonstrate exceptional dedication and resilience. Today, we've had zero confirmed positive cases of COVID-19 within the service. And a great deal of that goes to, as a service, we were well prepared with respect to PPE and some of those other things. We've been working hard. Social distancing has become our new normal here in the service. Our boardroom, for example, all of our leadership meetings are remotely. We're trying to do our very best to, as we respond to the needs of the community, to sustain our operations and to be prepared for the very statistically real possibility that we will have a case of COVID-19 within our service. We need to ensure that we can put measures in place so that if we have one or two people, which statistically out of 350 is very possible, that we don't have to self-isolate many more, exponentially more than one or two positives. So there's been a lot of work going on there. We have on the revenue side with respect to COVID-19, we've experienced some revenue losses. We've also had some increased expenses in relation to, like many other places, PPE, protective glass, etc. But we are happy to say that we are on track to remain within our allotted budget to absorb these revenue losses and expenses. So we remain within our allotted budget for 2020. And it's really important. We're so grateful for all the kind messages that we continue to receive from our community. We have received calls, texts, emails, thank you cards, flowers from members of our community who have just taken the time to kind of thank our members for the exceptionally hard work they do during an even more difficult time for all of us. It's one of those things that little things really mean a lot. And the emails and calls that we've gotten really do mean a lot to our members, who both for their own health, but as they're at work, in a difficult time like a pandemic, they go home every night. And probably, I'm sure, like for myself and all of our members, probably their greatest concern is the health of their family. So it's really been meaningful for us to get that kind of feedback. But, now, any questions on the COVID-19 side, James or Rodrigo, before I move on?
On that, Chief, I wanted to know, has the demand for service increased at all, or has there been a lull since the pandemic started?
I would say certainly within the first couple of weeks, there was a bit of a decline. We literally track calls for every day. We track calls for service. I would say now we've returned to pretty much normal levels, like 21,000 calls probably averages out to be about 200 a day. Please don't quote me on this because I'm just doing it roughly, but we average around 200, slightly more than 200 a day. And we've certainly been tracking trends with respect to, for example, domestic violence or other types of things. Because as we're all living in this environment, we've tried to stay focused, not only our volumes, but other specific call types that are increasing. Because both like from a community health perspective, what are the trends that we need to be mindful of and work together with other community partners? I would say short answer, we're back to normal levels now.
Thank you very much for that. James, was there anything else?
Just curious about your one of your last remarks there, and thanks for it mentioning that you're watching and responding to the shifts in the calls and how many of them might be related to the stresses and the anxieties that go with COVID. Can you speak at all to, have you gathered enough stats around that you can speak to where the upswings are?
Well, so short answer, James, I don't have the specific stats for that, but I know that, for example, our domestic violence calls certainly have not trended down. We've had a lot of conversations in the last few weeks about mental health. I think in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, we have to be mindful of when we think public health, just the mental health difficulties that this whole environment has been for all of us. So we certainly continue to get a lot of calls for service in that way. I can get back to you with specific numbers, but I don't have those at my fingertips here today. So the next kind of opening remarks, our budget. So as everyone is aware, last year, our board and council, they approved a very significant expansion for our service, for which we are grateful. If everyone recalls, so last year, several years in a row, we had trended, so call volumes had increased, response times were increasing. In 2019, for the first time ever, we surpassed $2 million in overtime, which equated to approximately 20 full-time equivalent positions of overtime. We also averaged approximately, I believe it was 42,000 hours of sick time for our members who were off due to work-related reasons. So the expansion that was approved last year, we are very much so, if that was 30.5 positions that was approved as part of last year's budget, to date, we have hired 15 new officers, 13 brand new officers, 2 experienced officers. We currently have 7 at the Ontario Police College. And we are, with respect to our sworn members, we are on track to have all of them onboarded by the end of 2020 as planned. In addition to our sworn members, there was approval for 13.5 civilian members, and that included 8 new 911 dispatch operators. To date, we've hired 9.5 of those, and the remaining 4 are expected to be filled. So we are on track to have completed the expansion. In the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, we're on track to have fully completed the transition and onboarding of all the new positions, 30.5 new positions. In addition to that, we've just hired a new deputy chief, as Paul Martin, our deputy, has retired. And in addition to that, we've just hired a new HR manager, because our HR manager is retiring later this year. So if you can imagine, in the midst of our COVID-19 pandemic, there's been a lot of work going on behind the scenes in relation to staff.
It's good. It's a lot. There's been a lot of change and a lot of flux, I imagine that is not easy for everyone to keep doing all this work in the middle of a pandemic with so many changing positions.
Well, and many different things, like whether it be, we were used to, like on the recruiting side, if you can imagine the interactions and interviews with folks, whether it be transitioning to virtual or things like that. There's so many different things that have had to happen in the midst of our day-to-day operations, which speaks to the kind of the resilience of our folks, because growing the service to meet the needs of the community, to sustain our ability to provide the service, it's a requirement that regardless of the times we're in, that's how we position ourselves for the future. But another thing that was approved as part of last year's process. I'm going to transition now to, we got approval last fall for a body worn camera pilot to pilot a small number of body cams for our members. One thing I want to note for the community is this was approved last fall as part of our budget process. And so for months, we've been looking at, and the goal behind this project last year was to do a number of things. It was to, first and foremost, we're committed to transparency. We're committed to best evidence for our community and for our Crowns. And so the goal, the idea of piloting body cameras for our members, that's been under development for months. We're right now in the process of finalizing the policy and the governance structures around that. If you can imagine, clearly the technical piece with respect to the cameras, that's really straightforward, but there's a lot of work that has to go into the internal governance, the policy, the privacy impact statements surrounding this initiative. I'm going to turn it over to Dustin. And so Dustin is the sergeant in charge of our community mobilization unit. In addition, Dustin is in charge of bringing in our body camera project. He is also in charge of our community resource officer program, as well as a number of other units. So Dustin has been very busy, and he's probably well equipped to kind of give us a little more specifics, Dustin, on the body cam project.
For sure. So, Chief Covey mentioned, the body camera pilot project was proposed last, I guess it was fall, and approved in the budget for 2020. So we've been working on it since about November. We've partnered with an outside professor from a university to assist us with some scientific components of the body camera pilot project. And we're looking to see if this is a valuable tool and if there's return on investment for the officers and for the public. And it'll begin September 1st, and it'll be a year long. And there will be updates halfway through and at the completion to the Police Service Board. We're excited to move forward with it.
One of the things, Rodrigo and James, we made a commitment on pretty much on all fronts, but certainly with our body cameras. It's important that to actually test in pilot property that we make database decisions. And so that's why we've engaged kind of an independent academic to help us through that process, which will monitor, correct me if I'm wrong, Dustin, but things like before, during, and after our members' perception, as well as the community's perception with respect to the use of body cameras. How does that impact community trust or community's perception of trust in the police with respect to body cams? There's some of the variables, Dustin, that we're measuring.
They are. Those are things that are going to be studied throughout. That pro-prosecution outcome, so things like how the how the officers wearing the body cameras will proceed through court with their charges, to see if the evidence that's gained through the body cameras assists in that way. And I think it's also important to note that the Privacy Commissioner of Canada, they've sort of stated that just to do a body camera project because it's, you know, it's wanted by the public isn't necessarily a reason to do it. You have to evaluate it to ensure that there's no other way to keep officers accountable, to gain as much evidence while not infringing on the public's right, because the public's right to privacy is the foremost thing that we're looking at during this, just ensuring that we're not invading people's privacy more than we need to.
If I could follow up on that, Dustin and Gordon, who would have access to the footage? I mean, is there a third party that would be reviewing the footage, or how is the footage actually used? Apart from, I understand for the purposes of bringing issues to court and evidence, but for the matter of increasing transparency, how would the footage be reviewed?
So to review the footage, it's actually stored with us. It's like any other private police information. There's freedom of information requests that can be followed through if the public or other people are looking to get the video. But as far as oversight, unless there's a specific complaint that's being investigated, video will not be shared other than with partner agencies like court or Family and Children Services or the Center of Forensic Science, something along those lines.
Any other questions?
Yes, if I could, I'll jump the gun a bit on our chat room because it's been very busy the last couple of minutes around a body cam question. So this seems like an appropriate time. I'm hearing from some of our participants that there's a lot of talk about it in the public, a lot of research now that some say that it actually has minimal impact on police brutality or accountability. Some in the chat room want to know what is the actual hope of this project with the GPS, and what are they hoping to have resulting from this pilot?
So Dustin, I'll start and I'll let you fill in the gaps as we go. So I think first and foremost, we need to make database decisions. So the whole idea with respect to the pilot is to pilot a small number of body cameras with a view to ensuring transparency, like within both. So best evidence for the courts, transparency for our community. But as we do that, we have to be mindful of that transparency also has privacy implications for the community. So, and that's why I know the researcher that we're working with has been involved in other research projects. But as you can imagine, all these questions that are coming up right now, these are the exact questions we have to ask ourselves internally prior to just issuing body cameras to our members. So this is very much a governance policy privacy consideration project, more than a technical device camera project. Dustin, anything in addition to that?
Oh, I think that's fair to summarize it, and to Councillor Gordon's comments about, you know, body cameras not having an impact on police accountability. That's part of what this study is going to look at, is to see if in fact the public has greater trust in officers who are wearing body cameras versus officers that are not wearing body cameras. So it sort of builds on a study from Durham Region, who did a body cam pilot project, and it's elaborating on that.
Thank you, Dustin. And just a follow-up from a couple of our chat room participants, a specific question about when in this project, the pilot, when the footage is taken, where and how is it stored? Is it stored through an independent sort of arm's length organization, or who has access to it, and how long would it be stored for, you know?
So all footage will be stored for 2.5 years. The only people that'll have access to it is the officers that created it. They'll have access to their footage that they've created. And obviously supervising officers will be able to access it in case they need to review something like use of force or discipline or something along those lines. And it's the company that we've contracted to buy the body cameras and the ecosystem that supports it. So what happens is the footage is recorded on the device, and then once the device connects with the Wi-Fi at the police station, it uploads there, and then it's stored on a secure server, and it's stored there for 2.5 years, and there's metadata attached to it, which is basically like fingerprints that will say who's altered it, who's touched it, and who's accessed it, and it can't be deleted without permission.
Now, and if we're good there, James, I'll move on to just an update on the Downtown Resource Officer Program. Okay. One of the things that, so another part of our expansion last year, probably since I got into this job as of last March 1st, 2019, one of the most, I would say, if there's one topic that I got the most feedback on was the importance of our downtown, the importance of our visible engagement downtown, both for our visitors, our residents, and our business owners in the downtown. A lot of people had wanted an increase there, and a lot of people cited an increase in things like break and enters and property crime downtown. So we had committed April 1st to start our Downtown Resource Officer Program. And obviously that was very close, probably within a couple of weeks after the COVID-19 was declared a pandemic. As promised, we did start that program April 1st. That was essentially, there were a number of officers who were have been seconded from other areas of the service. And so their full-time job is working downtown. Since April 1st, they have they've been downtown, and they've kind of gotten to transition into that role. Certainly the first few weeks were quieter than they would normally have been. I believe it's been well received. Our members really enjoy being downtown. And Dustin, you probably have a better update with some metrics and stuff for us in relation to overall how the program is doing and how our community is receiving it.
Yeah, so like you said, the program was really thought of in the December, November timeframe, and it got put into action at the beginning of April. It's been very well received. It was obviously a different rollout than we anticipated because it coincided with COVID. And recently in the last 2 weeks are when the public and the officers have really been able to engage one another. And with the reopening of businesses, the officers have been present and trying to really help make that move forward. They've been engaging with the park agencies like Wyndham House and Hope House and Drop-In Center. And they've been, they've just been trying to make good connections and trying to make lasting connections so that we can hopefully establish a safer and more vibrant downtown.
And that, that's kind of the prepared updates, Rodrigo and James. If you guys have any specific questions in relation to any of that, let us know. And then I know there's a list of questions that you want to get to as well. So just let us know where you want to go from here.
We have a lot of questions. I really appreciate the updates. I'm going to pivot a little bit here. I'm going back through some of the questions that we received in advance. I wanted to start with the topic of crime prevention. Something that I hear regularly from my work to constituents is that they do not feel safe at home. And generally it is people coming in, breaking into vehicles, garages, so property crimes. Would you be able to tell us about how much of property theft and break-ins are an issue for Ward 2 as opposed to the rest of Guelph? And is Guelph any more prone to crime, or are we pretty much on par with other municipalities in the area and oversize? And along with that, there was a successful pilot, the break entering auto theft team, but that was a short time limited trial that got a lot of success. It returned a lot of stolen items to community members. So we wanted to know if that was going to be restarted or if it's already been restarted now that we're getting back up to par.
Okay, so what I'll do, I'm going to start kind of more generally. We'll talk about the beat team, and then I can give you some more specific stats for Ward 2 after that. So the break, enter, and auto theft team last year in 2019 was a project that ran for a few months. It was very successful, both from our members' perspective, and I know our community really appreciated that program. And the reality with respect to that program, we didn't have the resources within the service to maintain it. If you can imagine, to take half a dozen people who are pulled from other areas of the service, when we are already working, when you have folks who are working 20 full-time equivalent hours of overtime to sustain business, when holidays come up and things like that, it just simply, it wasn't sustainable to keep all those folks in different roles. But so our members and the community saw the value in the work that was doing, in addition to proactive work to educate the community with respect to break and enters and auto thefts and thefts from a lot of property, and solving the clearance rates of those crimes were quite noticeable. Dustin is in charge of a unit that's called it's called our High Enforcement Action Team. As part of the expansion, that unit was increased by 2 people. And so now the goal is to, so that unit that Dustin has, while there isn't a unit that's just for break, enter, and auto thefts, the unit now has more people, with the goal of creating a unit within our service that has a surge capacity to respond to issues of priority or concern for the community. So for example, if Dustin has half a dozen resources who can be purposefully targeted towards certain areas of concern, then it might be auto thefts or break and enters. But in September, it might be 2 weeks in school zones and in crosswalks at the start of school for the safety of kids in school returning to school. At Christmas, it might be an increased focus on education and enforcement around thefts from vehicles at malls. So the goal was to basically increase the size of that unit. So while it's not single focused on one objective, we have that surge capacity to be flexible towards high priority issues at the time. Dustin, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you said it well. I think that the surge capacity is the main focus. I think if you asked 20 people in the city of Guelph what they thought the most important crime or issue that was going on, you might get 10 or 15 different answers. And the idea of expanding what is now the High Enforcement Action Team to not necessarily replace BEAT, but sort of take over when possible. Other things that are of importance are bike thefts are going on right now, and it's not rampant. I wouldn't say rampant is the word, but we're noticing an uptick in that, and it's very important to a lot of people too, because it's mode of transportation, it's personal property, and they're valuable. And in a city where we're looking to move to increased bicycle lanes and things along that line, I think having a multi-pronged focus is something that our unit will be
doing. And Rodrigo, it's also important to note that like our detectives in our kind of general investigations and this special projects group, they work a lot with Dustin as well. So it's being able to, like, we simply don't have the resources to have 10 different units who only do one thing. So we're having a sufficient capacity to kind of surge towards the most important priority at the time across the services. The goal there.
Just before we step to the next topic, what do you recommend for community members in Guelph who are concerned about, who have suffered from a couple of break-ins, who are concerned about just the safety of their family and of their property? Do you recommend that people, if they're in a neighborhood that sees regular break-ins, that they install security systems or extra lighting? Is there a general? What can people do?
So first and foremost, if something happens, if the public doesn't call us, we don't know. So I've heard sometimes people say things like, someone stole something out of my vehicle, but I didn't call the police. Even if we may not necessarily solve every crime, but if it's reported to us, then we can have the data required to know what the crime trends are, what physical areas, geographic areas are being more impacted by crime. I have some stats here specific to Ward 2. And for example, like last year, so if we look between 2018 and 2019, break and enters in Ward 2 were down by 44.9%. So 2018 was 85, 2019 was 49. Stolen vehicles between 18 and 19 was down 27%. Recovered stolen vehicles was up. Vehicle entries remained similar year over year. So the crime trends were in fact in Ward 2 starting to trend down last year for the first time in a bit. And these are the types of things why it's so important, like things like the beat team and the ability to have a capacity to respond to concerns brought forward by the community. Just the trends between 18 and 19, there was a downward trend. And that's just Ward 2 that I'm talking about there.
How does that compare to other cities? I mean, is Guelph, do we have more crime in Guelph than in other cities our size?
I think so, relatively. So I suspect the crime severity index numbers will be coming out pretty soon. They generally come out around this time of year. I don't know if COVID-19 has maybe delayed that, but typically, it's easy for us to track within our own service year to year changes. It's less easy for us to track in between municipalities. So I think probably to give you reliable data, we should wait for the CSI numbers to come out and see how we're doing year over year versus other municipalities, because I don't have access to that data at my fingertips, and I'd rather wait and give you the right answer, Rodrigo, than be wrong.
Yeah, that's good choice, absolutely. And I understand what that
means. You asked what else can the community do. So first and foremost, call us. As far as thefts from vehicle, the single greatest thing we can do is lock our vehicles. Not leave valuables physically open in our vehicles. Those are two certain things that we can do. As far as people ask us questions with respect to video cameras and lighting, if someone has video cameras and there is an audio or video recording, I guess from a certain incident, that information can be given to us. But as far as us telling people what lighting, what cameras, whatever, that would be more of a security expert, like home security.
Like you said, reporting is the main thing. We in the enforcement action team and our detectives work closely with our crime analyst, and it's important that they're reported, because we have maps, and if only one person in a neighborhood reports a crime, we have no idea that it's being targeted in that area, or someone's been walking around checking all the car doors. So it's very important to report and lock your doors and lock your car doors, because I live in the city, and I had a set of golf clubs stolen out of the trunk of my car last winter, and they were never recovered, and I felt quite silly for not locking my car.
And what we want to achieve, Rodrigo, is the statistics with respect to either our internal statistics or crime severity index numbers that are released nationally. In addition to the data, relatively speaking, Guelph is still a safe community. But in addition to the statistics, we want to make sure our community feels safe in their community. So it's the tangible, what does the data say, but the intangible of how our people feel, how our community feels about their safety is something that we're mindful about with all of these initiatives.
And along this topic of safety, the other big question that I get from my constituents on a regular basis is speeding. Will we be seeing more speed control happening now that we have the officers on board? I mean, I spoke to you before and I spoke to officers and I was told that the capacity just wasn't there to do proactive speed enforcement. When will we be seeing more speed enforcement across the city?
So thanks for that. The our traffic unit was increased by 2 people. And so what they do on probably almost a daily basis, as members of our community engage the service and our traffic unit to bring to their attention high volume areas or areas of concern, they prioritize their existing resources towards those areas. So like our traffic unit is certainly not exorbitantly resourced. And that's that balance we always have to have between kind of the resources available and the financial resources that costs for those resources. But our traffic folks, like whether it be, for example, we've received many calls about certain areas. Now that the Niska Bridge has reopened, for example, like that's an area we received a lot of calls. So on almost a daily basis, the sergeant in charge of our traffic unit will direct resources towards those areas. And also any major collision that is dealt with, those often require extensive investigations. So those traffic folks are also the individuals who would do the reconstruction work for serious accidents involving injuries and things like that. So if you can imagine, there's a lot of work that would go on from a subject matter expert perspective to prepare a report like that. So we certainly, we will continue to prioritize. However, I think the goal of trying to undersell and overdeliver, our traffic unit can't be at every location in the city at the same time. So it's a constant balance between what the service and the community, the resources we just have, versus how do we prioritize those areas in other ways.
Thank you for that, Chief. Now we received a couple of questions asking about the training the police officers received. So could you tell us now, especially now that there's more officers coming in, what sort of training is provided in terms of anti-racism or knowledge of First Nations communities? We had a question from Bruce, who's present here, asking whether any of the staff, senior staff, had participated in the carers blanket exercise, and if you would be willing to do so, and whether you have contacts with local Indigenous community leaders.
We are absolutely open to new training or new ideas within our community to better understand, connect, and have dialogue with our community. So as far as specifically the exercise that you mentioned, I know I haven't, and I don't believe any of our senior leaders have. However, I'm happy to follow up offline to learn more about whether it be that or any other different options. And is it Mr. Weaver? Did I hear, just see you nod your head, sir? We are very open to learning more about how we can do better. Getting to know and representing all aspects of our community. So short answer, yes, we are interested in doing more work with all areas of our community. I'm going to let Kevin give a brief overview of some of the training in place for our new members. Right? So they have some onboarding training, then they go to the police college and get some training. And then we have block training, we call it, which is mandatory training. Our members get. I'll just have Kevin give you just a high level overview of some of that.
Just to put in, if you can highlight whether any of that training does cover anti-racism or mental health knowledge, as that is what the questions we're getting.
First of all, we can always do better, and we're always looking at ways to get better. We're trying to raise the standard with regard to our training Currently, we are now working with, we're reaching out to members of our diverse community so that we can better learn to understand how we can serve them better and how we can potentially tailor our training to their needs. So that is where we're at right now. We're currently in that process of reaching out and developing those partnerships. With regard to specific training, when a new recruit gets hired, they get 3 weeks of in-service training here. So they get presentations by our training officers, and they also get a significant portion of online training. And that is through, and I'll give you the acronyms, it's CPKN, OPVTA, and our Ontario Police College Virtual Academy. Within those online forums, there is many, 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 many different forms of training, including diversity and de-escalation techniques. Those are things that are also taught in person by the training officers to our recruits. When they go to police college, they get all of this training in more specific and more detailed amounts for 12 weeks. And once they complete their 12-week OPC training, they come back for 2 more weeks of in-service training with our training recruiters to make sure that they have obtained the appropriate knowledge. We go over de-escalation techniques, scenario-based situations, and so they can apply that in real time. And what we have added this year is after that portion of their training, they go out onto the road with their coach officers. And what we've added now is halfway through their coaching program, which is 60 shifts. Halfway through that, we are now bringing them back in for 1 week of more in-depth specific training with regard to scenario-based de-escalation to make sure that they're not getting bad habits and they're learning the right way. And all sworn officers have the ability to do the online training. They all have the ability to do CPKN, those OPCVTA that I've talked about. Those are available to all officers. Some are free and some are at a very small cost, but we don't inhibit anybody. Everybody is able to take all that training.
And does that training apply for every officer in the Guelph Police Service? Have they all gone through those de-escalation trainings, or is it only the new recruits that are coming in and you still need to backtrack?
Yeah, so when the chief had spoken briefly about block training, so from January to June, we do our block training, and that's for all sworn members. That consists of many things that are required through the adequacy standards. We have to requalify our firearms and our defensive tactics, but through our defensive tactics training and we incorporate de-escalation techniques. We have scenario-based training where we have different scenarios with officers. They come in, they're not given any information, and then they have to go deal with the situation. Once they deal with the situation, then everything is debriefed at that point. So we do that training every year between January to June. And the specific training that I spoke about, that is for recruits. They get that. We heavy load them initially, and then everybody gets that every year.
Following up on something you said, you mentioned that you're working with members of our diverse community. Could you tell us which organizations you're working with?
Yeah, we've just developed a cultural diversity committee within the last month, and we actually just had our first meeting. And as a result of that meeting, we're reaching out to the Black Heritage Society, members of our Asian community, members of our Sikh and Muslim communities. I believe Indigenous community was on there as well. I can't speak to exactly which officers are doing what, but we're at the initial stages of that. We literally just had that meeting this week, our initial to reach out and to, again, to speak to the members of those communities so that we can better learn how we can tailor our training towards them.
Thank you for that, James. Do you have follow-ups on this?
Yes, there's a lot of questions in the chat. I'm gonna say in advance, we likely won't get to them all, but the ones that relate to what you were just speaking to, Officer King, are, there is almost, this is a challenging question, almost universal skepticism about the efficacy of the training methods that would give, we'll use mental health as an example. if they get a number of officers get a number of weeks of training, mental health professionals need a minimum of 2, sometimes 3 years of training. And some folks are seeing a dissonance between that as to what is the most effective use of our community resources when there's a clear difference in how much training they have.
I'll take that one, James. So James, I don't think that you are going to meet a police officer anywhere who says that police officers are mental health workers, nor are we social workers. I think that there is no doubt. Often we become involved when as someone is in crisis, and we are the 24/7, 365 service to help a person when they're in crisis. I think that some of the calls that we go to are very much symptomatic of a larger societal reality where I don't think we're optimally resourced to support. If I'm struggling with mental health or if I'm struggling with addictions, are the current societal resources in place to prevent me from getting to a place of crisis? So I don't think you're ever going to find a police officer who would say we are the first choice healthcare providers. We are simply the ones who respond in times of crisis when we get a call that they need that crisis resolved. We work closely with, so we have had for many years what's called mobile police, our mobile police and crisis, our integrated mobile police and crisis team. That's our impact team. Those are 5 embedded mental health workers that work with our members in our service. And Kevin's been on the front line and in charge of our frontline platoons for many years before he was in this role. And I'm sure he would probably agree with a head nod or disagree, Kevin. Our integration with our mental health team has transformed how we respond and can help those struggling in mental health crisis. But we acknowledge we are not primary caregivers. It's that how do we deal with that crisis situation so someone can get the care they need. So I think, James, to kind of come full circle on that, none of our members would ever think that it is our job to be primary mental health workers. We're just there 24/7 when sometimes nobody else is available in a crisis.
Thank you, Gord. So to echo some of the other comments, knowing that you wouldn't recognize yourselves as being the experts in those fields, how has that changed the process as to who answers the calls first? What's the collaboration, and especially around impact?
So right now, that's kind of the conversation with respect to funding and things like that. Is that kind of what you're talking about there?
Some of the chat questions are around if you are acknowledging, and I'm pleased to hear you say that okay, we're not mental health experts, but there are members of the impact team, for instance, who are. With that acknowledgement, has it changed how you are proceeding with how emergency calls get answered or follow-up is done?
So I think right now, as with many agencies, the whole COVID-19 pandemic has resulted a lot of agencies don't have as many of their members physically present. So I think this speaks to the complexity of the issue when we talk about community health and wellness. So for example, is there a better way, a better holistic way to provide more care for those struggling with mental health? I don't think a police officer would dispute there is, but the conversation and the infrastructure and the provincial and county level changes that are going to be required to begin to see that vision realized, I think there's a great deal of work and conversation that needs to be done. For example, mental health, as I understand it, healthcare is a provincial responsibility. A lot of social services is a county responsibility. So how do we start to have that multidisciplinary conversation to look at how society helps folks who are struggling while those conversations are being had, our calls for service continue to increase. So that we're kind of in the stage where like year over year, for example, our calls for service continue to go up every year as the population grows. So I think part of deciding how we change our resource policing is how does society invest in other areas so we're ready to really make my kind of a holistic approach to what police have a role in public health, but it's a much broader issue than just police.
Thank you for that. I think, again, reflecting on a lot of the chat questions, I hope this doesn't seem impertinent, but some of the questions are based around if you're acknowledging that there are experts in, for instance, mental health, what is the actual, maybe it's a historic reason or the current reason why police are even the first responders on that call?
I think the reality is when folks are in crisis, the police are the 24/7 available to help manage that crisis situation. As far as the holistic long-term care for folks, we like whether it be our impact team or the Guelph General Hospital or the extraordinary, where there's so many great leaders in our community, like Gail at the drop-in center, Rochelle at the community health center. There's the drug strategy. Our role is to help folks navigate that crisis moment. As far as what the societal evolution has been, that there may not be optimal number of resources before it gets to a crisis, that's a much broader conversation than the policing one.
James, if I could interject here, following this point, a little bit of clarity, Gord, if we could, the impact workers, how many impact workers are there, and do they respond to every mental health check call, or you know, what proportion are they available?
So we have 5 right now. Kevin, are you able to give a bit of a high level, kind of that interaction piece? Because you would have lived that for many years on the desk.
I was a staff sergeant on the front line for the last 4 years, so I can speak directly to that. We have, we just added to get 5 impact workers this last year. Obviously, they don't work 24/7. We have a number of officers that we work 24/7. They cannot realistically attend to every call. I would have to, without saying exactly, and please don't quote me on numbers, we probably respond to upwards of 20 mental health calls a shift, like every 24-hour period. And that's every day. And some of them involve weapons. Some of them involve just somebody that was in crisis without a weapon. We don't always take everybody to the hospital. When impact is available, we encourage that they go. There are times when they can't go because they're either not working or they are too busy with other calls. And we do what we call an impact referral, where they'll do some follow-up. A lot of these people that are in crisis, they're already part of the mental health community. So the community in that they already are aware of them. We are literally frontline trying to deal with the crisis at the moment. And that's all we can do. We're not professionals in regard to mental health. We get some training and we do the best that we can do. And if we had as many impact workers as we had police officers, would it make it easier? Yeah, of course, but that's probably not realistic. Impact workers, I could also add, they don't attend to a high crisis mental health call without a police officer for safety reasons.